Tonight we're talking to Ken Ritucci back in West Springfield, Massachusetts, by telephone. Ken is a fine caller and caller coach, and has been around the square dance world for some time, and we're looking forward to an interesting interview about his activities in the square dance wheel field. So, Kenny, let's start out as I usually do. Well, first of all, I should mention that today is February the 12th, 2004. And so, Kenny, why don't you tell me where you're born and brought up and a little bit about your childhood history and so forth.
Well, I was born in Waterbury, Connecticut, 1957, and I was one of three children. My mother raised us alone and did not have any square dancing history in my background at all. And basically, if it wasn't for me, there'd be no square dancing history in my family at all. And I got into square dancing in 1974. Started to call in 1975, so I've been calling about 28 years now, 29
okay.
years.
What was your first introduction to square dancing?
It was a fun night that the Park and Recreation Department was having in Waterbury.
Uh-huh.
I went down there in 74, and it was a lot of young people around my age, boys and girls, and at first I thought, you know, going to be hokey, but when I saw the young crowd, I thought, well, this looks like it might be fun, and sure enough, it was.
Well, good. Do you remember who the caller was?
Yeah, it was two brothers, Phil and Tom Moran.
Oh, yeah, right.
And they were teaching for the Park and Rec Department, and they had this big, big hall. I don't think the hall's there anymore, but it's huge. Could have held probably about 50 squares.
Uh-huh.
And they took turns alternating tips and teaching.
All right. So where'd you go from there, then? You get other square dance experiences back early in those?
Well, what happened was the group of us started going out dancing that fall of 74 into 75, and we graduated, and then we drove up to the New England Convention that year. It was up in Portland, Maine. That was when they were getting about 8,000 to 10,000 dancers just for the New England. And we were literally just trading off partners and dancing almost, I'd say, seven nights a week.
Right.
At that point, I said to myself, I'm going to get bored, you know, as any 17-year-old would do, learning and dancing. But I said, maybe I'll do what that guy does up there on the stage, not knowing, you know, what it would encompass. But that's when I went to a small summer session that summer with Ed Ruddy and Dave Haas at Dave Haas' barn in East Hampton, Connecticut. They're running a weekly callers group. And then from there, Clint McLean gave me a flyer to Earl Johnson, Al Brunage's Caller School up at East Hill Farms.
Right.
And that was the first time I went up.
Okay. So what was your impression of that Caller School?
Oh, I thought it was wonderful. I mean, I went up in 75. I went up every year. I skipped 80 only because I was doing a summer camp up in Maine. I couldn't make it. And then I went from 81, 82, 83. There was a whole group of us at the time, a bunch of young callers coming up at the same time. And we just kept going back year after year. And, you know, some of us actually started taking it serious after maybe the third or fourth year. We weren't chasing the waitresses up at East Hill.
Right.
And they ran obviously the biggest school in the country. It was a fantastic school and got to meet a lot of great callers.
Right. Well, who were some of your other mentors in the course of your beginning calling?
I'd say beginning call was probably Ed Ruddy, Dave Haas.
Yeah.
Earl and Al, obviously. And I'd have to say probably Clint McLean.
Oh, yeah.
Although then there was callers that I learned from that were on the guest staff. Was Jim Mayo. Lee Cotman was there 1 year. Ed Foote. Jack Lazary was very good. They had Deuce Williams in 83. That was the last time I went. That was an advanced school. Deuce conducted the advanced school at the same time that Earl and Al were running the regular school. And then in 84, Earl and Al asked me if I'd want to sort of be an apprentice and help out with the school the year after.
Oh, yes. All right. Did... I lost my train of thought. that seems to be a prominent disease these days. But, okay, long as we're talking about calling, what do you find appealing about calling?
Well, I like the fact that you can entertain, that you can, as you can take a group of dancers, and well, from the teaching aspect, you take a group of adults or kids, mainly adults, who really know nothing about something, and you see your finished product, I think, at the end of class, and you see how well they can dance.
Right.
I like the entertainment aspect of it. When I go and call now, and it took me years to hone this, you're not just up there calling. You're really an entertainer in some ways. You have to be involved with the whole aspect of what's going on, and in between tips as well. It's a whole evening instead of just six or seven times up on stage.
Right, right. Well, the thought that I was trying to get at was, how did you evolve into running the caller school yourself?
Oh. Well, only because Earl retired and Al finally said, the hell with it. I was on staff 83, and then in 84 and straight on, they had me on staff. Sometimes would be just coming up for a day, depending on the amount of students they had. And my degrees in college was education, and I did teach school for a couple of years, and I really loved to teach. And I just would stick close to Earl and Al, and they saw how enthused and serious I was about it. And having run the biggest and longest running school, I think, in the history of the activity, they wanted to, when they thought it was their time to turn it over, they wanted to turn it over to somebody they felt would continue the tradition. And Randy Page and I were fortunate enough to be asked to do that.
Right. So
that was one of the highlights of my career, was to be asked to take over Earl and Al's school.
Right. So what's been the experience of the school since then?
Well, the school's been great. We took it over. Our first year was in 93. I eventually sold out my half of it in 99 to Mike Jacobs. And as of this year, I'm actually starting my own school, a smaller scale school, probably about 10 students, working with Norm Poisson up in New Hampshire in his hall. But the school was just as big from 93 through 99, 2000 when I was there. We brought in some of the bigger names, you know, of this generation. We got the Tony Oxendines, and we got Mike Callahan to come in, and we had Johnny Preston and Jacobs himself. We actually did an advanced school one year. I think it was in 96. We ran an advanced caller school with, in addition to the regular school, we had like 46 students.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really big.
Right.
I think 12 of them were just for the advanced challenge school, and they came from all over Canada. And, I think we had some overseas people. We even had students come from Taiwan.
Wow. Well, that's interesting. In the meantime, what about some sort of a home club program of your own?
Well, I've had several clubs throughout my whole 30 years of calling. I've had basically, in Western Mass, there's not much of a home activity at all, but I had, at one point at the height when I was out seven nights a week, I'd probably have three or four clubs of my own. The last club I had was the club up in Brattleboro, Vermont, Green Mountain Steppers, which I, in 2000, when I sort of took a little reprieve, I didn't totally retire, but almost did, I gave that club up because I wanted some time off, but still kept up with some guest appearances. So I've taught several classes. I can't even remember, you know, hundreds or thousands of students, plus numerous workshops at the advanced and the C1 level as well through the years.
Right. Well, what's been your experiences with, like, local festivals and conventions and so forth?
Well, like anything in the activity, they were doing very well. You know, the little one we have here in Western Mass Fall Festival used to get 1,000 dancers a day, you know, for the one day. I think now we're lucky if we get maybe about 250. The New England Convention, which I have the pleasure of programming this year and next year up in Brattleboro, is probably going to shoot for about 1,400 dancers, where in the heyday we probably got maybe 8,000 to 10,000.
Right.
So festivals and conventions, the Connecticut Festival, For years, we'd get 3,000 dancers on one day, and now they're lucky they get maybe, I don't know, I haven't called it in the last 3 or 4 years, but I am going back this year, probably about 300, 400 people.
Right, right. So you've been affiliated with the Western Mass Callers Association then?
Yes, I've been a member of Springfield Area Caller Association since 1980.
Yeah.
And Connecticut Callers Association since 75. Obviously, member of Caller Lab. I was on the Board of Governors for 6 years.
Yeah.
I was on the Executive Committee for 1 year. I was also chairman of several committees during the late 80s and most of the 90s, the PLUS Committee and some of the quarterly selection committees and such. And then, of course, being an accredited caller coach, I'm on that committee as well.
Right. Well, you've been certainly busy. So what's been your experience concerning round dancing?
Well, personally, I've queued one round. I carry it with me, and whenever there's not a cue or something, I'll get up and tease, and I actually can still cue it. I think it's Sleepy Time Gale, tips of my fingers, I think it is.
Right.
And took round dance lessons when I was breaking out into square dancing, and I enjoyed round dancing. You know, back just like in Connecticut, New England, 20 years ago, we had a host of great round dance cueers, like we had a host of great square dance callers, and of course, a lot of them aren't around anymore. But as I got busier with calling, I sort of didn't go out and round dance anymore, but I would still do some rounds in my dances if they were easy enough, and even to this day, I'll still do some rounds, but, you know, round dancing is a great activity, and it really is a good partner with square dancing. I've seen in some aspects of New England, certain cueers have gotten very popular and have big programs where basically they almost do their own thing. They have their own round dance parties and their own round dance clubs, and
right.
Lots of times they don't even need to be with the squares.
Right. What about contras?
Well, contras, I used to do contra dancing in the early 70s when I first started this activity. Clint McLean and Rusty McLean and some of us younger guys would go up into New Hampshire, and we would do contra dancing, you know, the Duke Miller and some of these other callers for, I'd say, like 8 at night to 8 to 11:30, almost midnight, and we'd have a blast, and we would drive around and do some contra dancing, but obviously modern Western was our main thrust.
Right.
And I remember up at caller school, Alan Earl would always have Duke show up with some of his dancers and put on a performance for contra dancing as well.
Right. But did you ever call it?
No, I've never really called contra dancing. I did buy some records. I think maybe in my earlier days I would do Slaunce to Donegal, and I would do some of the famous ones, you know, but I never got into it. It just wasn't something I spent a lot of time on.
Right, right. Well, have you ever had time for any other hobbies?
Well, I coach my son in baseball every spring. So,
great.
And he's 14. He's on the 13-15 league. So I think another year or two of that, and then at that point I think I'll give that a break because that's very time-consuming. And I used to do a lot of hiking when we started square dancing. We met up with a group of dancers in Connecticut who like to hike, and they're the ones who really got me involved up into the Monadnock region.
I see.
We hiked Mount Monadnock several times. And then we'd go to a dance at night. We'd sleep over at a hotel or something up in Keene.
Right.
So I used to do some hiking. Haven't really hiked much in recent years, although this past summer I did take 4 kids up to Mount Monadnock. And we hiked the mountain, first time I've been up there in 20 years.
Uh-huh. Well, that's great. One of the things I've been asking the other callers that I have interviewed is, do you have any regrets, anything you wish you'd done differently?
With calling or with the activity?
Yeah, or either one, or both.
Regrets, I guess we all can say we have regrets. I don't think I have any regrets from the educational standpoint. I basically accomplished what I wanted to, and probably Probably not. Maybe I think the one regret I probably had is when things were going hot and heavy. I probably should have cut back on my schedule to make more time with the family, and then I did.
Right.
You know, hindsight being 20/20. You know, you get caught up into the rush of everything, and
sure.
The contracts are flowing, and the festivals and everything. And next thing you know, you're looking at 3 years of solid bookings, and you know. But now as you get a little bit older, you start saying, well. You know, if I only did things a little bit differently. So I guess that would be my biggest regret.
Right. So you would have spent more time with the family then, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. Well, the other thing that I've always liked to ask is, where do you think square dancing has been, and where is it now, and where do you think it's going?
Well, I'm sure you've heard 1,000 different opinions.
Yeah.
I'll add mine.
All right.
I think we've seen the best days of square dancing. I think the 50s and 60s and 70s probably were our biggest. I don't think even maybe the first half of the 80s after that, I think the decline started. I personally don't think we'll ever get back to that being that big. I think society has changed, and in some ways square dancing has not changed with it. You know, as you certainly know, years ago, traditionally, the man worked all day and the wife stayed home, so she was anxious to get out of the house. And it was a form of inexpensive fun activity, and everyone went and did it. Of course, we didn't have DVD players and VCRs and movies and all the types of minor conveniences. Plus, we didn't have a lot of this two-couple working, young kids, and, of course, not just working, but working different shifts and different hours. People are tired, and society's changing very fast that way. Everybody wants, because of this workload and this rush to pay your bills and meet your family's demands, people need things quick and fast, and unfortunately square dancing is not a quick and fast activity. It's trying different programs, the 10-10-10 program, but in essence that still keeps you in it for a long time. Because once you learn the 10 weeks, then you can stick around and learn the 10 more. And before you know it, you're there for your traditional 30 anyway.
Right.
Where's it going? I'd like to say it's going to get better. I'm hoping it will. I'm sure there's parts of the world and certainly parts of the country that are doing okay. I would say most of them are not anymore. I know here in New England it's not doing it. In the New York, New Jersey area, clubs are folding. Dancers are getting older. You know, there's fewer callers, caller schools are down. I think it's just the way it is. I mean, I just don't think we have an answer. There's not one answer that's going to snap it back. We don't have the financial funds to do some really serious national, you know, on TV, in-your-face advertising.
Right.
They're trying. I know Call Alive and the Foundation are constantly raising money. But, you know, you need serious money to hook up with, you know, Coca-Cola and some of these other companies that can get on your TV screen and really show a different flavor of what people's images of square dancing is.
Right.
People keep saying it's going to rebound. You know, maybe in certain areas it might. Overall, though, I just don't see it. I don't see it ever being as big as it was. I think we all need to change our philosophy of what it is, and I think we're starting to see that where, you know, 2 or 3 day festivals are now being cut down to possibly a day and a half. You know, you can't offer 20 halls anymore. You got to go down to 6 or 7. So I think we all have to do with less because there is less out there.
Right. Well, what's your impression of the what we commonly call the CDP program or the community dance program?
I think when it started out, it was. I remember I was there when it started out. I was on the board, or just getting onto the board at the time. And I think it's a great concept, a community dance program. I think the concept of it is in a lot of ways what's needed for today's modern society. Unfortunately, we're sort of our own worst enemy. We're in a dilemma here where we say we want to come up with community dance programs, and we just want to keep it simple. And yet, at the same time, you know, which group of callers does that? It's a fine line to pick how you're going to structure your program. If you want to stick with something like that and you've got a successful program, the urge is, then you got to fight is not to bring those kind of people over into, you know, a full-blown program, fear of turning them off.
Right.
Yet at the same time, it's also our nature to want to challenge them more. We want to progress. We want to do more. I don't know. I mean, I think the concept of it as well, I don't think that it's probably taken off as much as probably Caller Lab and other leaders wanted to see it, and hence I think we've got the 10-10-10 program now.
Right.
Which they're trying to incorporate more of a easy intro program, just come for 10 lessons, just let them dance after 10. But at the same time, they're also saying, well, but by the way, 2 weeks later, we're going to start another class. You guys can still come and dance. You help them out.
Right.
And we'll show you more calls. And so we're sort of repackaging the same,
right,
the same product.
Right. Well, I was just wondering if maybe the ultimate goal might be going back to traditional style dancing and a more varied program, like including rounds and mixers and contras and so forth, where anybody can just drop in any night they want to and not on a regular basis and be able to dance.
Well, that's a great concept. In fact, getting back to contra dancing, I've noticed in the local newspapers and in, like, the advocates, I mean, there's, like, I looked the other day and I saw four, five, six different places in one night of one weekend of just contra dancing.
Right.
So I think contra dancing is bigger than probably we Western leaders want to admit, because lots of times they don't even need to bring a partner, and they certainly don't need any instruction, and anything that's taught is taught that night, and you dance, you know, the long swings and the dancing to the steps of the music.
Right.
And at the end of the night, you're one big, hot, sweaty ball, but you had a great time.
Right.
You go home, and you don't have to worry about, you know, club responsibilities. You don't have to worry about traveling anywhere. If you want to go back, if you miss three Saturdays in a row, you go back, and you can just dance that Saturday you're there.
Right.
So probably it would be nice to, if we can see more of that start to evolve, not just strictly contra, but maybe throw in some rounds and things. But then again, think of the mindset of the square dance callers that we've trained for the last 50 years.
True.
It's been strict choreography. It's been modern Western. I mean, even myself included, I would have a hard time just trying to run a contra night or something. I would have to get somebody to do contras if I just wanted to host an event.
Right.
Couldn't do the rounds myself. I mean, who's going to do this?
Right, right. But,
you know, most callers just don't have the experience or the skills to want to do that.
Right. Well, you as a caller coach, do you spend any time looking at that angle of it?
We do talk about it. We do talk about contras. Not being an expert in it, I don't go into it too long, but normally usually there's somebody there, or if we have someone on staff that helps. We do talk about rounds. We talk about the importance of rounds. We talk about the whole full flavor, and we always, you know, especially if Al comes up in the summer, we always want to hear the history and the tradition of the activity, because I always like the students to have a well-rounded education, at least background of where it is, but where it's come from.
Right.
I think, though, again, this is just my opinion, I think if we're ever going to get to where we can incorporate multi-programs in one night, you know, a lot of us would have to change our way of thinking and our way of living, and we'd have to, you know, seriously make an effort to make that happen.
Right. Well, it's my impression that a lot of the modern Western programs don't devote any much time to teaching people how to dance, actually. As you say, they've spent all their time working on choreography.
Choreography, and the other thing is, too, we don't teach them so much to dance with the music and the rhythm and the beat.
Right.
But when you hear callers call, you can tell right off that they don't understand.
True.
I mean, they're starting to call three beats before they should be placing the next call.
True.
And they're starting to run the dancers.
Right.
And, of course, a lot of that has to do with their lack of understanding of music and rhythm. And also, you know, with the invention of sight calling, well, now you can get to look at the dancers. You would think that would help, because at least if you looked at the dancers, you can sort of stay on cue with them. But a lot of callers, newer callers starting out who don't know sight calling, read. And reading isn't going to help them with the floor.
Right.
It isn't really going to help them with their timing.
Right.
So there's a lot to it. And like you said, if these new callers come up and they haven't been taught to dance to music, they're not going to have that mindset to want to call utilizing music and rhythm. I do a whole presentation on just music and rhythm because it's so important.
Right.
You know, it's like and what Al always taught me. It's, you know, how you sound.
Yes.
It's, you know, it's not what you say. It's how you say it.
Right, right. Well, one of the other things I wanted to ask you, Ken, is have you done any recording?
No, I've never recorded a song. I was asked to do one. Global Music Production about 10 years ago asked me if I wanted to, and also Silver Sounds asked me at one point.
Yeah.
But it was just it just never really interested me.
Right. Okay. So where do you stand now? Are you full-time, part-time, or...?
Oh, I'm just part-time. I have a full-time job.
Right.
And busy with the kids. In fact, I've just started this past January, 3 weeks ago, I just started going back to school for my master's.
There you go.
So my calling is, you know, now that I've sort of come back into it a little bit, you know, the dates are picking up down the road. I don't think I'll ever be out 7 nights a week like I did and not have a life.
Right.
You know, if there's anything I've learned, it's that, you know, it's unless you have a partner in life that this is all you do is eat, sleep, and drink it, you know, there's other things in life than just calling.
Right.
And especially with the way the activity has gone, too, I think it keeps me healthier and fresher knowing that not every Friday and every Saturday night I got to be out.
Right.
Now I'm much more selective. I pick and choose where I want to go.
Right. Do you have a home club program right now? Or?
No, now that I've been back, I haven't picked up one yet. There's a club on the other side of the state that wrote to me and asked if I'd be interested in teaching their class and being their caller. Of course, they're just doing exploratory right now. They've asked other callers. And
yeah.
I said, sure. I said, you know, I'll put my name in. That sounds like something I might want to do.
Right. So you're guest calling some of the clubs around the
just
area?
Just guest calling, you know, anywhere from Connecticut to New York to, you know, almost near the Canadian border, just Massachusetts, and or basically New England, New York at this point.
Right. Have you been down to my old club, the Mad Hatters in Danbury?
Yes, but not in the last 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
But they're still hanging in there.
That's what I hear. It must be close to 35 years now.
Yeah, that's... No, I think they celebrated their 40th last year.
Is that right? I lost track. Yeah. Well, they didn't invite me to come back.
No, I don't... Well, I don't know who called it or nothing. They didn't ask me for it either, so...
Yeah, well, Randy used to teach there, of course. Randy
that's
Page.
Right.
Yeah.
I don't think he called it either.
Yeah, well... And, of course, he lives in Danbury, so...
Yes, he does.
All right, well, I think we've covered pretty much everything, Ken. Do you think of anything else you'd like to add?
No, I just commend you for your efforts on this project. I mean, how many interviews have you done?
Over 100 now.
Wow.
Yeah, I was looking back. I started in 1996, actually.
And wow.
I covered all of the... and a few of the people that I've... interviewed in the past, have since passed away, you know, like Bob Osgood and so forth. But,
right.
Max Forsyth and, golly, goes on and on. But so I just wish now that we'd started earlier, actually. How I wish we'd been able to interview Ed Gilmore or Les Kutcher. And,
oh, that would have been wonderful.
You know, and Pappy Shaw, gosh. But, of course, a lot of those have got some writings that we can look back on. Did you do any writing at all outside of this one article that I just got on my email? It's called Liar, Liar, Pants on Fire.
I've done several articles from the late 80s and early 90s. I used to write every month a column called Byline for the Northeast Dancer magazine, and then it was... I ran it up to probably 94, 95, and then last year they asked me if I'd start writing again, so I do write a bi-monthly column for them now.
Oh, yeah.
But in my younger days, 10 years ago, I used to write some pretty provocative stuff. I mean, I sort of really took it to the people, and I wasn't afraid. I got letters You know, I got bad letters, good letters, you know. And
yeah, I remember some of your articles.
Yeah. Now I sort of tone it down. I just try to play the middle of the road at this point. But it depends what's up and what stirs me. And I asked if I can just write every other month because of my work commitment. I didn't want to be committed to an every month thing.
Right.
And then now the National Magazine puts me, they asked for my articles, so they print them. Whenever I send them in as well.
Oh, yes. Okay.
I enjoyed your book, by the way. I read it like one night.
Oh, great, great.
I remember you signed it for me last April at the convention. I think
right.
I read it like when I got home.
Well, great. I appreciate that. So, well, Kenny, I think we may be just about finished then. We got everything on one side of the tape. And I really appreciate your taking the time to talk with me tonight. I was very interested in your experiences. You've been rather unique for the business and compared to a lot of people. And I know you've had a successful run, and I wish you all kinds of good luck in the future.
Well, I thank you, and I'm honored to be asked to speak with you tonight, and thank you for including me in your group.
Well, your tape will go into the archive of the Square Dance Foundation in New England, and hopefully someday some researcher will look back and...